Alan, tell me about the charity.
We are East Cheshire Eye Society, and we are a charity that supports people who have visual impairments or are affected by sight loss. We were actually established in 1875, so our 150th year anniversary is 2025. And we were initially set up as a result of some of the sight loss that people experience working in the silk mills. Things have progressed since 1875 in terms of the charity, and we've become much more of a charity that people would understand and expect today. We've been based in Macclesfield since 1875, and we were on Queen Victoria Street from 1920 until about 3 years ago. We moved because the premises were no longer really fit for purpose, and we wanted to move to new premises, which would be a better experience for the people coming to visitors and we're talking to, but also for the staff and volunteers who are working here. So about 3 years ago, we moved to our new base at 11 Market Street, which is in the centre of Macclesfield, just near the Town Hall. And with both of those premises, one of the things that's important to us, because people with vision impairments sometimes have difficulty travelling, is that both premises are accessible by train and bus and easy to get to by public transport.
The town centre location is ideal, isn't it? It works very well.
It can make all the difference. The location we're in now is kind of tucked away a little bit, so it's not as visible as it was previously. But what we do is we always ask people to make an appointment before they come and see us. And if people are not sure where we are or they think that we might be difficult to find, we arrange to meet them at a spot in Macclesfield that's familiar to them. And once we've walked them across and they know where it is, then they can find their way back afterwards.
And what sort of services do you offer?
It's a whole range of services. We do cater to people's individual needs. So we always talk to them and work out just what it is that might help them. But it can range from things like we run regular support groups where people can come along and just meet other people, like-minded people, to chat, to share what they've been doing, but also to share their experience of sight loss or some of the things that they might have done to make things easier for themselves, which might then benefit other people who hear that. Those support groups can also get guest speakers. Sometimes that might be to speak about sight loss, but often it's just about other things that might be of interest to people. And they also, they play games and they arrange local trips out. So they might go to a local garden centre and then go to the cafe there. Or they might go for walks in the local park. The groups really work out for themselves what they particularly want to do, and then off they go and do it.
So do you sort of facilitate that? You make things a little bit easier?
We do. So we set the groups up in the first place, and then we have volunteers who help to run those groups. They become self-managing, and the people who are going along determine what it is that they want to do. But we're always there to give them help and support with that.
I suppose you have to base whatever you do on the individual, because everybody's different and their sight loss, what they're experiencing, could be totally different to what somebody else is experiencing.
It is. I mean, and although the support groups cater for a wider number of people, in terms of the actual individual support that we give to people, it is very much a case of sitting down and asking them what their issues are, how it's affecting them personally, and what we can then do to help. And we always say it is very much an individual experience for people, and what one person with, for example, macular degeneration might come in and find useful doesn't necessarily mean that it will be the same for the next person who comes in. It doesn't mean that if one person comes in who's been diagnosed with sight loss and has reacted emotionally in a particular way, that it will affect the next person in the same way. So it's very individual, and it is a case of talking to that person to better understand what they need and how we can help them.
So that's some of the services you offer. What else do you offer?
We also, within our resource centre here at Marketplace, we have a lot of equipment that we demonstrate to people and show them how to use that equipment. And it could be things just to make life easier around the home. It could be things like magnifying glasses, things to help people to be able to read better. Simple things like if you're making a cup of tea, you know, how do you do that without having to put your hand in hot water and burn yourself and so on. So it's just simple aids around the home that can make a lot of difference to people's lives. We actually have some physical activities as well. So we run visually impaired Grand Green Bowling Group, for example, which will have sighted guys to help the visually impaired people with that. and we have a visually impaired walking group, again with sighted guides. During the winter months, they tend to walk around local parks, but during the summer months, we'll go much further afield, so whether that's walking down by the canal or taking trips out to local arboretums, you know, it can vary from that. We also do training, so apart from the equipment training I've mentioned, we do training with people to help them to understand their sight loss and to better use the sight that they've still got. And in particular, what I'd like to mention is we do training with technology. So things like smartphones or iPads or computers. There's a lot of accessible technology built into those pieces of kit already, but many people, A, aren't aware of them, and B, don't know how to use them, or they are aware of them. So we do training to make people aware of what's available to help them, and then we let them go away and practice, and then they can come back and do some more sessions. And it's really important technology, because it is improving all the time. And even if it's simple things like an Alexa at home or another model of that kind of thing, then they can be really useful to people. So we just help to make sure that people understand what's available and how they can get the best use out of it.
And how many sort of staff and volunteers do you have here?
We're actually quite a small charity in terms of the staffing. So we have two part-time staff. We always say we punch above our weight. We do a lot of things, but we do a lot of things because we have a lot of really good volunteers who are helping us. And we're supported by a range of active volunteers. And we often have about 40 volunteers who are supporting us. And we always make it very clear that we couldn't do half or more of the things that we do without those volunteers. They really do make all the difference to us.
Lifeblood of all charities. Every charity we've spoken to says exactly the same thing, and the people are very, very generous with the time.
They are, and they're pretty amazing, really, the things that they do, the things that they're willing to do and get involved. And they make things possible, but they also make our life a lot easier in the process. And you're right, I mean, you know, we work closely with a lot of other charities in the work that we're doing, and many of them rely on those volunteers. And we do have the same kind of discussions around how they're helpful. I think we've all had the same experience where during COVID, the number of volunteers actually reduced. But that has slowly been increasing over the past couple of years, so that we're certainly back up to a good number of active volunteers, and hopefully other charities are as well.
Now, one of the things we always talk to charities about is funding. Do you have fundraisers, or do you apply for grants, or is it a mixture of that kind of thing?
We don't actually have fundraisers specifically here. As a small charity, we don't have the capacity to employ people to do fundraising for us particularly. So it's all done within the work that we're doing anyway. But it is important and it's essential. So we are an independent charity, and we are not funded by the government or by the local authority, by the NHS. So all the money that we need has to come through grants where they are available. They're not always easy to get. And in some ways, they're getting harder to get all the time. We do fundraising, so that could be traditional things like, I was going to say rattling your can on the street. You're not allowed to rattle the can, you have to stand there with a can and look hopeful. We get legacies of people, which is fantastic. It's really generous, so that people leave money to us in their will. And then we get some corporate support, so some local businesses who either do fundraising for us or they give us donations. And that's fantastic, and it really makes a lot of difference to charities like ourselves. And it's certainly something that we're trying to promote more if we can do. And with our 150th anniversary coming up, we're hoping to reach out to local businesses to say, come and help us in our celebrations and help us in our 150th year.
Well, one of the questions we wanted to ask as well, because you mentioned it before about COVID, how did it affect your service users?
It was really difficult for our service users, being people with a visual impairment. And one of the biggest impacts on people with visual impairment is social isolation and loneliness. And you can imagine, if you remember during COVID times, how we were all required to stay in. So that's increasing that loneliness and social isolation. And we actually found with a lot of visually impaired people, when lockdown was eased, that there was a lot of concern from people about actually going back out again onto the street. And we did things, for example, where we set up, some of our volunteers went out and just walked around with people to get them over that first step. During COVID itself, we set up telephone calls with people, regular telephone calls, and we set up telephone groups so that they could all talk to each other over the phone. There also were things that, you wouldn't necessarily think about. But during COVID, when we were allowed to do the things that we were allowed to do, they were limited with things like keeping 2 meters apart from each other, or standing behind lines all the time and waiting. And not to touch anything. Mm. You know, if you're going to a supermarket, don't touch anything unless that's the thing that you're buying. But in the visually impaired world, things are very tactile. So actually touching is an important aspect of what you're doing. You also, with a visual impairment, can't necessarily see that you're closer than 2 meters to somebody, and you can't see lines on the floor. So people really struggled with that, and there were some situations where other people were getting quite angry because they hadn't realised that the person was visually impaired, because it's not always something that you can see. And so, again, it was a really difficult time for people, just managing the things that, for people who are fully sighted, we were just taking for granted. There were lots of direct and indirect impacts on people during that period.
I suppose, again, it's one of those things, unless you experience that, you wouldn't think it would be an issue. And then lo and behold, of course it is.
Yeah.
And it's obvious at that point. But until you get to that situation, you wouldn't necessarily know.
There are many things that, like you say, if you directly experience it, or if you know somebody close to you, you're seeing, experience those things, you get a better understanding of it. And certainly when I came into this role, I wasn't aware of a lot of the things that I was taking for granted, that for somebody with visual impairment, it's very different. And so just walking around the streets, for example, walking through town with the number of A boards that have been advertising local businesses that visually impaired people can't see, or you get low-hanging, I don't know, flower baskets, or people these days sometimes trail their wires for charging up their electric cars, and people with vision impairment. So as you walk around the local environment, you suddenly become really aware of these things that are real difficulties and hazards for people with vision impairment that they have to negotiate around.
Now, you're talking about the 150th anniversary next year, and you're talking about local businesses. Have you got any other plans for what you're going to do to help celebrate? I mean, it's a huge achievement, isn't it?
It is. We're very proud of the fact. We think we're probably one of the oldest, if not the oldest, charity locally. And if people are hearing this and they are of our same age, just let me know, because I'd love to hear other people, other charities of that same age. We're just starting planning for that. We're very clear that we want to have a celebratory evening, and we will have an evening meal. We don't know where or when yet, the early stages of that. As a charity, we already run, every 2 years, we run a thing called Vision Day, which is an exhibition of sight loss equipment and local services, and we'll certainly be doing that as well. We hope to set up some projects that will involve local schools and get them involved in maybe an art project where they can come along and do some exhibits that we can then maybe have a little competition of. So there's quite a few things in the pot for consideration, and we're kind of slowly working them through and pinning them down to be exact things that we can publicise.
Now, if anybody wanted to volunteer, or if anybody wants to donate or anything like that, what's the best way of getting in touch with you?
So we've got a website, which is www.eastcheshireeyesociety.org.uk. You could email us at info@eastcheshireeyesociety.org.uk. Or you could just give us a call on 01625 422 602, and we'll just get back in touch with you and make arrangements.